when do we stop and turn around and say, no, I am not working on that road project. I am not working on a greenfield development.
Are you interested in the donut economy of cities? What do you think about the city as the outside living room? How can we create proper density? Stay tuned for answers from Sarah Stace.
What is the future for cities? Do you want to learn more about them? Do you want to know how others think about them? Do you want to be part of the conversation? Then this is the right place.
Welcome to What is the Future for Cities podcast. Today, I will interview Sarah Stace, urban shaper, strategic thinker, and innovator of cities. We will talk about her vision for the future of cities, land use and transport planning, donut economics, professional responsibility, and many more. So let's start with a proper introduction. Sarah Stace is a city shaper who thinks about the interplay between cities, land use, and urban transport. She is WSP Australia's regional executive for infrastructure advisory, providing advice on urban policy, economic business cases, and decarbonization. Over the past 25 years, Sarah has worked for federal, state, and local government, as well as the private sector. This includes 6 years as Director of National Urban Policy for Infrastructure Australia and leading walking and cycling strategy at Transport for New South Wales. She has written and co-authored 20 publications, including for the United Nations and Australian government. And with that, Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for your appearance on the podcast. I highly appreciate your time. Before we jump into the future of the cities, what does the city mean to you?
Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. And I want to acknowledge that I'm joining today from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. I guess the future of the city to me means a lot of things, actually. One is, as we just talked about with Welcome to Country, is that we will be integrating, connecting with country, acknowledging country and working with country much more into the future. And I think that's going to be really important as we try and understand our use of resources, our connection with the earth, the sky, the water and the landscape around us, as well as our connection with each other. So I think that's a really wonderful thing that is definitely on hold for us in our future planning and our future cities. I guess also something that we'll cover throughout this podcast is that there are some aspects about cities that are really wonderful, how we connect with others in that social connection, having our children go to the park and play with each other, people walking and connecting with each other or sitting in cafes. They're all the wonderful things that happen in cities. And we also have businesses connecting and doing great work. And I think for many of us, as we return to the office, the joy of meeting with our colleagues or going out for coffee with someone or for drinks after work, we're remembering that social connection through our workplaces as well. So I think that cities have a lot of great things about them. But what I'll also be covering today is about some of the things that are these, what economists like to call negative externalities. But actually, we have a role as professionals, as urbanists, planners, engineers, architects, and so on. We have a role in the future of our cities. And I guess I'd really like to talk about whether we are passive in that space and we just do what our clients tell us to do and we write nice policy, but we never intend to implement that or fund it. And as professionals in the consulting sector, what is our role as having an active voice and having an active role? So I'm really keen to explore that through this podcast.
We had Michael Brown talking about Aboriginal ideas, explaining what country means around September. However, your description of the city providing the social connections was really interesting because you highlighted social connections and work was just providing these opportunities to make also social connections. This is interesting because the CBD, at least, usually gets highlighted as the job center, as people going into the CBD for work. Do you feel that the city itself is a place for connection for people?
Absolutely. It's our third space, right? It's the outdoor living room. Whether that's in your local suburb and you're connecting at the beach or at the local park, whether you're taking your kids to sport and you're talking to some of the other parents or the coach, or in the playground, you've taken your kids to the playground or you're taking the dog for a walk. That third space, the living room, is so important. And particularly as we have more people living in medium and high density housing, in apartments and so on, having that living room outside is really important. And it just encourages people to get out and exercise and connect with one another, whether that's bumping into, say, an elderly person walking down the street and they're walking to the bus stop and you just have a little social chit chat. And I think that that does happen in the CBD context as well. It might be a little bit more formal, like you just, or you chat to the barista or you're meeting with a colleague. All those social connections are just so important. And I think we did miss that during COVID. We got other benefits like working from home, but we did. That's one of the nice things about coming back in, I think.
We will come back to the professionals a bit later, but let's come back first to the negative externalities you mentioned. What are the three biggest fears or concerns regarding the future of cities for you?
This sounds very negative, and I am going to be very negative because I think that there are a couple of things that concern me. I might not get to three. I'm going to talk about two. My biggest concern is this assumption that we can and should grow our cities, get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the second one is isolation. That comes hand in hand with some of that. So I'll take you down that thread. So connecting with that second one, I guess, is around, are we providing for everybody in our city or are we only providing for some people in our city? So the first one is this growth and expansion of our cities. I did go to a wonderful presentation last night by the former Minister for Transport and Minister for Planning, Rob Stokes. His topic was on wicked assumptions. And he talked about all these assumptions we place into our planning systems and so on. And one of those assumptions that I think we make is that growth is good. Growth is okay. And my concern with this, and I'm going to sort of touch on quite a big topic here around paradigm, the paradigms that we have in place. And I know, Fanny, we were talking before about this sort of how do we bring about a paradigm shift in our way of thinking. So I really work in this area of land use and transport planning. That's my sort of specialty area. I'm an architect and I also work a lot with transport planners and economists. And I've been introduced recently by one of my colleagues, Tim Sullivan, to this framework of donut economics. I'm not sure how I didn't come across this before, because it turns out lots of people are quite familiar with Kate Raworth's work on donut economics. But I'm really interested in how this applies to city planning in particular. So I did come across a paper that was just released in July this year. It's called A Manual for Donut for Urban Development. So that was released by the Danish Architectural Press. And I do encourage people to go and have a look on that when you just Google Donut for Urban Development and you get a manual and an appendix with all this scientific evidence and a toolbox and so on. Really great. It didn't quite answer my question for me because it's focused on specific projects. So you're already within the precinct context or you're already within a city context and you're working on a development in particular. So it looks at embodied materials, for example. It wasn't quite what I was looking for. So I'm going to present, a planning approach to that. So for those who aren't familiar with donut economics, the idea is that if you imagine, picture in your mind a donut, and then from the inside, you've got a pressure moving outwards so that the hole in the middle of the donut, you've got the basic needs that people have. They need air, fresh air, water, food, shelter, social connection, and so on. So those needs, they need to have things like a house, they need to have a bed, you know, all these things that are absolutely essential for humans. That's pushing an outward pressure from the inside, pushing out to the donut. And the donut kind of forms that just and equal, equitable society. And then outside the donut, you've got where the donut gets so big that it is pushing out towards our planetary boundaries, particularly on the impact on climate change, and the impact on using up resources. And there's a finite amount of all of those things. And so that's sort of your inward and outward pressure on the donut. And the problem is that in Australia, we are using so much resources and having so much impact on the climate that we need three or four Earths in order to, if we all lived like Australia or like the US, we would need multiple Earths just to meet those needs. And of course, we can't all have that. So I think that's a really great paradigm for explaining the fact that we need to supply enough, sufficient for everybody to live, but not so much that we're pushing beyond our planetary boundaries. So I thought, what if you applied that to a city planning context? if you imagine that spatially and you've got a city like Sydney or Melbourne or Perth or Brisbane, and the metropolitan boundary that is set by your planning instruments is the donut. And we need to provide within that donut of the city or the metropolitan area sufficient for everybody to live equitably and justly, to meet their daily needs with food, access to parks, access to jobs, all those education, all those things. But the problem is that we allow that to leak out into further expansion and growth. In fact, Melbourne has a target for 30% expansion year on year. 30% of all new housing can go beyond the donut. That greenfield expansion, if you think of that spatially, is going beyond our donut of the metropolitan area into more and more greenfield development. And so I think that is a big fear that I have, is that the cost of developing that greenfield is absolutely enormous. There is an economic cost, a climate cost, a social cost, a long-term cost that we will never recover. So what you're doing when you have somebody moving out to these greenfield developments, the Victorian government through Infrastructure Victoria has calculated that every single home needs to be subsidised in a greenfield by $170,000 per home. That's what it costs the government to build each of those homes. That's not including the developer costs and so on. And so they're subsidising $500 million a year to allow and enable that expansion. Now, that cost is somewhere in the order of, I should have double checked my figures, but it's somewhere in the order of three times, perhaps four times more than infill development. So there's an economic penalty that we pay for that greenfield expansion. And at the current rate of trajectory, by 2056, that's another 1 million people that are living in greenfield development by 2056 in Melbourne. So that's massive. And I guess the question is, so we've just talked about the economic cost. The environmental cost is also huge. So from a resources use, you've used a lot of resources that have gone into new roads. You've had to build new hospitals, GP clinics, schools, parks. That expansion requires a lot more resources than an infield. When you're doing an infield, you still need to provide those things, but it's more compact. And so there's less resources. And then from a climate point of view, you're basically locking in those additional million people into the next century or more of car dependency. And it doesn't matter whether they were in a petrol car or an electric car, it's still going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to ever provide the full amount of public transport you need to remove the car dependency. You just cannot retrofit that much expansion towards that. So you're setting up people in a lifetime of car dependency and beyond, the generation and the next generation and next generation. That's a very long description of my biggest fear for our cities. The second one is this loneliness complex. So I'm going to illustrate this with the story of Margaret. Margaret is, let's call her about 75 years old. So she has retired. She worked a good long life. She's retired. She was very lucky. She got a little bit of a pension and that subsidizes her little bit of savings she had in superannuation. She's really enjoyed her retirement so far. She's been out on cruise ships. She's had a couple of grandkids. She's traveled the world to visit them. And she's had a really wonderful retirement. Now she's gotten to more elderly retirement and she's had a little bit of a bingle at the shopping centre where she crashed her car into a shopping trolley and she bumped someone. Not too hard, they weren't hurt, but she got a bit of a scare. And she went to see her GP and the GP said, well, we need to test your eyesight. And, oh, sorry, Margaret, but it looks like you're getting a bit of glaucoma and I'm a little bit worried about your reflexes. I think we're going to have to really think about taking away your driver's licence. Now, if we think from Margaret's perspective, her donut, right, that inner circle, the inner hole in the donut, all of her needs are met. She lives out in the suburbs. Her needs are met by the car. She accesses her food and her shopping that way. She accesses her friends. She goes and visits her grandchildren. She goes to the park. She goes to bing. All these things are only achievable with a car. And she's locked into needing that car to get around. So as soon as you say, you're going to have to give up your driver's license, Margaret, her donut has to shrink, right? That's unfair. So then the development industry, the real estate industry comes and says, well, Margaret, we've got a product for you. It's called a retirement village. And if I'm Margaret, I'm going to say, hang on, so you've taken my car and you're taking my house. That's outrageous. How can you do that? I've got friends here. I've got family. I know the local chemist. I know the local butcher. You're going to take all of these things from me? No way. The problem is we have set up a system where Margaret is trapped. She's trapped where she needs that car to reach her basic needs. She loves her house and her community, and we're going to take all of that away because she's just too old to participate in our society. And so I think that's a real problem. And I've run the statistics, depending on where you are. If you're in a fairly inner city area with quite a high proportion of young people, about 33% of people are not able to drive because they're too young or too old. And across Australia, it's around about, it's approaching 40% of Australia's population. They're either children, so they can't get a driver's license, or they're too old, like Margaret, where they're having to give it up, or they're living with a disability. And that doesn't even include households that choose not to have a car or they can't afford one. So we're saying that only 60% of Australians are allowed to fully participate in our society because they need a car. And I think that is on us as professionals to actually be providing for so that 35 to 40% who can't drive or don't want to drive. I just wanted to put all those together around what my biggest fears or concerns are, is that we're growing too far beyond our boundaries. And that reflects on our planetary boundaries. And we're not providing for everybody to live equitably in our society and fully participate because we've set up this massive car dependency.
I understand these fears. These are not easy concerns. Let's move with the donut idea. Does every city have to provide the same opportunities? Is every donut the same flavored?
No, not necessarily. Like, I'm from Perth originally, and I was just there about 3 weeks ago, and I gave a presentation to the Urban Development Institute. Perth is a very long, long linear city. And so you could argue it's just a very vertical donut, very long, skinny donut, right? Whether it has chocolate sprinkles or not, I don't know. But, you know, people live along the beachfront, it hugs the coast. Their donut is a different shape. But the problem there is that they have expanded north-south so far. And their problem is that they do build a train line. So what they do is they build a freeway. Through the middle of the freeway, they run a train line. And it's great in concept, but in reality, they're building all these transit-oriented developments with these train stations dotted along these lines. The problem is it's not pedestrian-oriented. So what they do is they build it right in the middle of a freeway interchange. And not surprisingly, nobody wants their home. You don't want high-rise right in the middle of a massive, massive freeway interchange. Not surprisingly, a lot of people have to then drive to the train station and so on. But let's ignoring that problem for now. They've created such a linear city that it takes a good couple of, I think it's probably one of the, if not the longest city in the world. So it's the most physically isolated city in the world. And it's also the longest city in the world. And so you have to drive or catch the train for a good hour and a half or 2 hours just to get from one end to the other. And you're driving at 110 kilometers an hour without stopping once. It is a massive, massive city. And I would argue that they are well and truly beyond the donut, right? And if you could guarantee that all those people living on that train line are going to be within a nice walkable distance, maybe that's okay, but we know they're not. Yeah, I think their donut is a different shape. I just don't know that it's a different flavor. I would have to think about maybe some of the regional towns and so on, but even somewhere like Orange, which is a regional town in New South Wales, something like 95% of the population there is within a 5 kilometre radius. Beautiful town. The problem is they've got 23 roundabouts, and so it's actually quite unwalkable, and so actually lots of people drive. So I think we can still think about the donut and its paradigm. It needs to be centred on compact mixed-use land use, centred on good public transport, and that needs to be frequent and so on. And I just don't think you can provide for that in a suburban context. I haven't really thought too much about regional cities at this stage. Maybe that's a future podcast.
The principles could be the mixed land use, the public transport, and
compact. Has to be compact.
Yes, compact, yes. Planning ideas. And over that level, would it result in the same city everywhere, or each city would have their own characters preserved?
I think every city already has its own character. And part of that is set by its connection with country, the landscape that it sits on. Melbourne is on the Yarra River, and it's quite a flat landscape with the Dandenongs at one side and the Port Phillip Bay and so on. It's got its own unique characteristics and country. Sydney obviously has this very magnificent harbour that is extremely unique. I think, you know, maybe Vancouver and San Diego have a similar sort of harbour setting, but it's quite unique and beautiful. Perth, again, is very different, and Brisbane with the Brisbane River and so on. So you've already got a very dominant landscape form. And the city is going to be largely shaped by that and the fact that most of the city already exists. It's just then the type of development that you layer within that that responds to its context. I don't think you're going to get rubber stamp Le Corbusier style developments all over the world as a result. Mm-hmm.
Your fears were the assumption of we must grow and we reach or even already reached the outlines of the donut and the isolation. Regarding the isolation, is isolation the problem or is it a symptom?
It's totally a symptom. The problem was we created a car-dependent suburbia that we can never rectify. And so the solution is don't build any more of that. The symptom is the loneliness. The symptom is having your car taken away from you and you've got no other option. That is the symptom of the cause that we created.
You mentioned the statistics for the greenfield expansion that the government has to subsidize each home with $170,000. Does this include the surrounding infrastructure, so the roads and the hospitals and the schools and everything else you were talking about?
Yes, I think that's the whole of government cost for when you provide all those other things. But often people don't see that. They just see that they got the sticker label on the house and that's what they paid. But in fact, the cost to government for all those other services and so on averages around $170,000 per home.
It was really interesting, Ted Bill, you talked about how financially for the people who buy homes, it's much more affordable to buy if we strictly speaking about buying the home without any considerations about the future, to buy a home in the suburbs with a big site and six rooms than in the CBD or close to the CBD, close to the transport nodes, an apartment with two or three rooms. Do you fear that the economic side for the individual buyer is also changing? Would it be comparable for an individual buyer to buy an infill instead of going to the suburbs if we are strictly talking about buying the house?
Well, I think that raises two questions. So one is, if the government is already subsidizing in Victoria $500 million a year for greenfield development, what if it instead spent the same money subsidizing for the right types of infill development? And infill does not always mean high rise. It doesn't mean you have to be living in an apartment. It can mean you're building duplexes or townhouses or semi-detached houses. It doesn't have to all be apartment living. So one is, you know, where is that money being spent? And if you're already subsidizing $500 million a year, maybe you could subsidize that elsewhere, perhaps even to affordable housing for the nurses and the emergency workers and teachers and so on. The second question is, again, this assumption that people want to live in these sort of fairly isolated greenfield suburbs and be car dependent, and that that was somehow an option for them. And that also, what we hear from developers and so on all the time is, but that's what people want, therefore we should provide. And I guess my question is, at what point do we as a society and as a government say, well, you may want to have that, but it's not going to be cheap. You may want to have that, but you actually can't have it. So at what point do you say, no, this pushes beyond the planetary boundaries. We can't afford to economically as a society, and we definitely can't afford this as a planet. If you want to go and have a 2-acre lot with horses and sheep and so on, either it's not an option or it's going to become a scarce commodity and you have to pay for that. But at the moment, what we do is we say, oh, well, you know, let's try and make that as cheap and affordable for you as possible. And we're even going to subsidize you to do that. And we're going to subsidize your four-wheel drive. And we're going to subsidize the roads for you so that you can have the lifestyle that you want to have. And everybody else is going to pay the penalty, including your grandchildren. That's fair. That's quite a paradigm.
Why do you think that this subsidy model was established to go beyond the current limits of the city and build on the fringes, build on the suburbs?
I just think we've always accepted that that's okay. At what point has anyone questioned that and said it's not okay? No one.
Well, today we are doing it.
Today it's not okay. It's not acceptable. Let's just say no. I'm going to have a lot of people hating this, but I think we should be questioning our assumption that it is actually acceptable, okay, and that we subsidize that.
I completely agree that we need this paradigm shift and we need to question our usual management of our urban assets. So this is a really good question if people are thinking about it and being outraged. And then let's talk about it.
And I do want to raise, I guess, another impact that we haven't touched on yet. But I guess, again, if we follow the climate impact into actual dollars and what it costs us as taxpayers. So we just talked about the direct subsidy that occurs to that greenfield expansion. But I want to talk about the cost of climate impact in Australia. So Infrastructure Australia, I worked there for 6 years. And Infrastructure New South Wales has put out a report in 2021. They talked about the cost of natural disasters. Now, that is growing very substantially, and that's for a couple of reasons. One is driven by climate change very clearly, and the other one is as we continue to expand our cities and suburbs and so on into the wilderness, into forests and into mountains and into floodplains and so on, there is an impact of that, of natural disasters, as we encroach onto these ecologies. So if I recall, in around 2014-15, the Productivity Commission under the early days of Abbott released a paper on the cost of natural disasters. And at that point, they said the cost of natural disasters is getting bigger and bigger. And off the top of my head, it was something around $5 billion in 2014, 2015. It was actually a brilliant report because 900 pages long, and I read it all and I could not find the word climate change. I did a word search. It was completely silent. It was brilliant, brilliant bureaucracy. Now, this in 2021, the Infrastructure Australia and INSW released this report, and they talked about the fact that it now costs us $18 billion a year in natural disaster recovery, the cost of natural disasters. So that's a pretty massive growth from 9 years ago. And then they said by 2050, the cost of natural disasters will be $39 billion a year. That we as taxpayers will have to continue to subsidize natural disasters. So we are getting hit at the hip pocket for this climate disaster, let alone all the trauma that people suffer, losing their homes, et cetera, et cetera. That's quite aside from that. This is just the direct cost of recovering from natural disasters. And in that report, they said that it was about infrastructure resilience. In fact, it almost assumed that mitigation was impossible, which is a bit scary. But it basically also said that the best time and most cost-effective way to mitigate that is through planning. That's our role as planners, as we plan our cities. In fact, just don't build stuff out into floodplains and into natural national parks where you're going to be next to a bushfire zone and so on. I just wanted to touch on that. There was a very funny case study that the Productivity Commission in the 2014 report did, because they gave it a case study of an apartment building in the Gold Coast where it was at high risk of a coastal inundation. And so the planning permit for it said that in order to, the planning condition of consent said that they needed to install a life raft and life jackets in the lobby. That was their mitigation measure. Anyway, so I bring all of that up because, again, this, we don't question. The reports are out there, but we don't read them. We don't think, what is the impact and what is my role as a planner? What is my role as a professional, an architect, an engineer in this climate disaster that we're currently under? And can I do anything to change that? We'll come to that in a moment.
Yes, we will. But before we jump into that, let's leave this doom and gloom and let's look at the bright side. What are the three biggest opportunities and strengths regarding the future of cities for you?
Yes, actually, despite all the doom and gloom, I am very optimistic about our cities. And I think that the strengths of our cities, which we touched on the beginning, is people live in a city because they want to be together. That's a very social, it's an animal thing. It's we as mammals. But as humans in particular, we love being around each other. That's where we thrive and we grow. That's why our cities just get bigger and bigger, is that it does better for business and it does better for people. And so we bring ourselves together into these cities and suburbs and towns. Coming back to that question of the street as the third space, that's where that social interaction thrives. Yes, it can happen in your backyard in the garden or at the barbecue or in your lounge room, but it also happens out on the street and at the park, like I said. And about 60, depending on where you are, sort of about 60 to 80% of all public space is on our streets. And so that's where I do that day-to-day work. That's why I'm president of Better Streets, is where we're basically saying our streets are there to be occupied by people and enjoyed by people. We want people to be out on their street, interacting with their neighbours. We want them to be playing on the streets and so on. And that the streets are not only there, as they have been for the last 60 years, they're not only there to move cars as fast as possible or to park cars. They're there for our social lives to happen. And so I'm very optimistic about the massive, again, it is a paradigm shift we're seeing, particularly in our bigger cities, towards this movement and place idea or the link and place idea, that hey, actually, I think we're starting to agree as professionals and in our ministers and so on, are realizing that, gosh, streets actually do have multiple uses. And so I'm very happy about that shift that's occurring at conferences and in on our professional interactions and so on. We're seeing this massive movement underway. We're seeing greater spending on that. And that makes me very, very optimistic. I think that we can and will make more changes on that. I think, though, in Australia, we're quite far behind and we've got a lot of work to do on that. But we can look at our peers in Europe, in China even, and parts of North America as well, where we're seeing that shift. And COVID also helped us a lot moving towards that, where we did start to put in outdoor dining and parklets and so on instead of car parking. We put in pop-up cycleways. And that did represent a massive shift in our thinking right across the world and also particularly on the eastern seaboard in Australia.
Did you say 60% of our public spaces streets?
Yes.
Even in Australia?
If you stand at the front of your house or your apartment and you look at the width of the street in front of you, probably 20 metres curb to curb, and the length of the lot that you're on might be 20 metres front to back. So, yeah, it does add up very quickly. It's just that we have come to think of that asphalt as not public space. We've come to think of that as car space. But it's actually, it is publicly owned land and can be brought back to being used for play and joy.
That is really surprising because I come from Europe and I lived in Budapest, and Budapest has way fewer public parks than, for example, Melbourne has. And that's why it was really surprising that even in Australia, the streets give 60% of the public space. That's just mind-boggling. However, you touched upon how COVID gave us some good examples of how we can use these spaces, really community spaces. Do you think that these examples are to stay?
It depends on the context. So in New South Wales, pretty much all of the pop-up cycleways are being converted to permanent cycleways. In Melbourne, I think there's been a bit of a mix of those. And I think when it comes to things like outdoor festivals during summer, or in my local community, they closed some car parking during COVID down at beaches. For some reason, you couldn't go to the beach because you might get COVID. And so they closed all the car parks at the beach, and then kids started using them with their bikes. And so they realized actually it's created a winter pedal park, and that's continuing way after COVID. So I think there are shifts occurring. It may not be everywhere. It's definitely not uniform, but I think we have definitely turned a corner on that to say, actually, let's question our use of streets as much as we did before COVID. And we demonstrated that you can have very significant shift in mode shift if you have the right settings to do so.
The other thing is you described the city as the place for connection. You described this socializing aspect of humans as a strength and an opportunity for cities. Do you differentiate between rural and urban living? Because the connections can be also found in rural towns. We don't have to live in the CBD for those connections to happen. Do you differentiate between rural and urban living?
I don't really see why there would be a significant difference. Again, you may have a slight difference in density, for example, but it's just as important, perhaps even more important if you're living in a regional town or a rural community, to have that social connection. And it's probably one of the things that does attract people to living in those regional towns, is that you do get that close connection with your neighbours, unless you don't like them, in which case that might be problematic. But you definitely do. You know, you get to know people in town, you get to know their kids. And my dad used to work as a doctor in regional towns across Western Australia, and he knew everyone. He'd go to the airport or he'd catch the train. Like I hopped on a train once in Perth, and the conductor said, "Oh, Stace, this is an unusual name. Your dad's not a doctor in Narrogin, is he?" He was my doctor. People do. They get to know people very, very well in those regional towns, and that is what makes them attractive and lovely people to live in. So I do think that that public social space is just as important for that social connection.
When you talked about how we could say that, stop, we are not doing any more greenfield development for big cities, do you think it would be also beneficial to highlight the existence of rural towns that, okay, maybe not Melbourne, but Ballarat and Bendigo and in New South Wales. I will not say anything because I'm not that familiar with that. Not highlighting Sydney, for example, but the rural towns that maybe not develop these big centers because they are already big, almost useless in creating these small, compact, walkable, with good public transport centers, but focusing more on the rural towns.
I was in Bendigo a couple of months ago. I came for a climate conference there. And they have ambitions to get to net zero by, I can't remember the exact date, but they did want to have quite a big impact on their transport and other carbon budget, which is really wonderful. And this is obviously before the Commonwealth Games got cancelled. Bendigo and Ballarat are goldfield towns, so they were developed well before there were cars. And so the city centre is actually designed to be very walkable and quite compact. The problem is that, again, we've got this unfettered growth around that, and so they can't sustain a good public transport system in the current form. So I think it is just as valid for Bendigo and Ballarat and other towns like Shepparton to actually be doing much more infill development. Again, people do move to these regional towns for a whole range of reasons, but one of them is around housing affordability. But we need to be thinking about the whole living affordability. So if someone has to move to a regional town or they choose to, then they have to own a car each per person and they have to drive everywhere. There's high petrol costs, insurance. The cost per person of owning a car is well over $10,000 a year. That was a arbitrary calculation from quite a few years ago. So it would have gone up quite a bit since then. And so we're locking people into living unaffordability in the name of housing affordability. And I think that is still problematic. And it really doesn't matter whether you're living in a regional, rural, or metropolitan context. It's just as valid. And we do need to be providing public transport, but we can't in a very sprawled, tuck environment. So I would be saying we need good train or express bus connections into these regional towns, but we also need to be providing good public transport within those towns. But the only way you can make that stack up is if you, again, increase that compact, mixed-use, walkable development. And again, it doesn't have to be high-rise, but it does mean townhouses, it does mean duplexes. And we know that all those ingredients are what make any place walkable. You need those three things. In regional New South Wales, it needs to be less than 70% single dwellings. In a metropolitan context, it's less than 30% single dwellings. It doesn't matter what the other type is, as you said, duplexes and so on, as long as it's not single dwellings. Once you reach that threshold that I mentioned, you get a lot more people walking. The other one is having mixed land use. So it's sort of that job density and providing things like local shops and so on, gyms, supermarkets, all of that will provide jobs. So you need to sprinkle those in. And then the third biggest factor is intersection density. So as urbanists will call it, permeability. But basically, if you had to put that into a geospatial map, it's intersection density because you're allowing people, there's quite small block sizes. There's lots of people around. There's lots of things to see and do. And you can put any permutation of that together. If you just have those ingredients, those three ingredients, you explain more than 50% of all people walking on a street are there because of those three things. And all those explain a compact mixed-use development. And then there are other things like providing public transport and so on. But all those, the next factors are fairly small in the scheme of things. Slow street speeds also help because they increase your crossing opportunity and therefore the street's permeability. I say that because they are so fundamental to all locations, irrespective of where they are. If you have those ingredients, you'll get more people walking. And then it's nice to have things like trees and shade, of course, particularly in hotter environments. That's not the key ingredient that makes people walk. So I do think that that applies universally anywhere in Australia.
Which means we could also say that these are universal design principles, which would result in different outcomes. Which brings us back to you. What is your role in establishing the future of cities?
There's a few things in that. One is, as I said, I've just been talking about sort of some research that myself and others have done. This is building on Billie Giles Cortai's work, who's based in Melbourne, and she has a whole team of people, or she's actually just retired, but she leaves this incredible legacy of a huge amount of research and a big team who are working on trying to figure out, like, how do we share the data and the information about what makes places more livable and walkable? They've just released a report recently looking at people's mental health living in apartment buildings and what's the role of planning in that. They said they looked at the SEP 65 in New South Wales, the bad BAD guidelines in Melbourne, and a similar one in Perth, and they looked at how apartment buildings create more healthy environments for people. So they've got this incredible amount of research, and that was what led me down this path into looking at what makes places walkable from that sort of data analytics perspective. So I think one role as professionals is to keep ourselves up to date with what is the research telling us. Don't just assume that because it was okay when I went through uni in the 1990s, that's showing my age. What are we assuming and how are we making sure that we're keeping ahead on best practice? So I think that's really important for us. And when we do learn something new, we share that, whether that's through LinkedIn or what used to be called Twitter, now called X, sharing that with each other through those connections and attending conferences and so on. I guess coming back to those things that I covered earlier about my biggest fears about the growth and expansion of our cities. Last week, I was at the AITPM conference. Now, I know when this gets published, it will be a little bit old news, but every year I like to attend the Australian Institute of what's called Traffic Planning Managers. At that conference, we talk about transport planning, basically. And this colleague of mine, Tim Sullivan, who had introduced me to Donut Economics, gave a presentation about whether or not we should be building new roads. He gave the example of the Welsh Road Review, where in Wales, they have reviewed all of their roads and said, first of all, we need to set a Paris-compliant carbon budget. And we need to set a transport budget that meets that Paris-compliant carbon budget. And if you haven't got that in place, well, you shouldn't be building any new roads. If you have all of those things in place, then you need to ask the question of, is this road going to help us meet that compliant carbon budget? Now, it's very hard to prove that a road is going to meet your carbon budget targets, partly because of the embodied energy in the road and partly because of that ongoing use of the road into those sort of scope 3 emissions. And so it got me thinking, okay, well, if you decide, if you're Wales or any other country that chooses not to build new roads because you want to make sure you're minimizing your impact on climate, how do we as planners respond to that? If we keep building and expanding, how are people going to get there? They can't all catch the bus or catch the train. That's what got me thinking. Maybe we don't need that expansion of our cities. Maybe we build a new road. It's only to create an additional path so we get that increased permeability. But maybe we don't need the new roads. Maybe we, as that infill, Macquarie Park is a classic one. They've put in new metro stations and so on, but it's a very large block sizes. They need to improve the permeability. So they need new paths, but maybe they don't already need to be car roads. So I think one of the questions I'm really hearing from a lot of colleagues at the moment is starting to ask, what is our role day to day in our climate impact? And because we're in this climate emergency and we recognize just how urgent it is, at what point do we wait? Do we wait until government policy says we've created a carbon budget now and it turns out we're not going to build any new roads and new developments? Do we wait for that? Or as I hear from a lot of other colleagues, well, yeah, but we need to earn the money. I've got to have a mortgage. I've got a job. How could I possibly say no? But if the clients stop putting out the work, that might change things. We might have to retool ourselves and respond as a market. Or other ones who say, well, but if I don't do that project, someone's going to do it worse. So I've got to be the professional who takes on this work, but I'll try and minimize the impact. And other ones who say, well, it would be nice, but you know, the client never asked for it. It was never in scope. These are 4 layers of responses, all of whom have this, I think, quite self-deluded belief that it's okay because I had to pay my mortgage. I had to keep my job. I had to maintain my professional capacity. I couldn't embarrass myself, et cetera. And they're all very, very valid concerns, just like Margaret's concern when she loses her driver's license. We've got to make a living. But I think at some point, when do we stop and turn around and say, no, I am not working on that road project. I am not working on a greenfield development. By all means, if it's out there in the market and someone else does it, I can't stop them. But if enough of us as professionals stand up and say, no, I do not do this type of work, at some point, some politician, some client, someone somewhere is going to notice that the professionals are saying no. And it gets harder. And we've had that with the mining industry, where it's become harder and harder to insure and finance a new mine. And if you said no to a mining fossil fuel project, you're probably not a complete pariah as a professional anymore. And likewise, if you said, when I was an architect, I used to turn down any job that involved gambling. I would not work on a hotel or a pub fit out if it had gambling machines in it. And my work thought it was a bit weird, but they honored that. And so likewise, if you said, I'm not working on a casino, I'm not going to work on an arms dealer, that's okay. At what point do we say, my job is not to build new roads because it's going to induce more people to drive, and I think that's bad for the planet. So that's where I'm laying down the gauntlet. What is our role as professionals to turn around and say enough is enough? And we are no longer here to produce your beckoning to the government or to clients about building new greenfield expansion and new roads. That's my question. I'm certainly committed to that, but I'll be interested to see how other people respond.
Sarah, you have been very generous with your time. So I'm really grateful for your answers. And as a last question, do you have any closing comments or requests for the audience beside this question?
I think I would like to leave that to your listeners on this podcast about all I ask is that you self-reflect over the next few days, months, years about what is my role? What is my role in mitigating climate impact and mitigating resource impact? So, yes, we need to create the enough sufficiency for people to live fair, just, equal, comfortable lives. We can't all live like the Kardashians. Really just reflect on, you don't necessarily have to act today, but reflect on what is my role in this profession and what could I do better? How could I make a voice, or how can I make my voice heard so that the work that I do is bringing about climate positivity, not just no impact? How am I going to leave this earth better as a human being and as a professional? That's all I ask.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
It was really interesting to hear from Sarah how donut economics can apply to cities. Not to mention her description and call to action for professional responsibility, Ted Bellew also asked professionals to speak up in episode 182. You can find out more about Sarah online. All the links are in the show notes. What was the most interesting part for you? What questions did arise regarding Sarah's approach to the future of cities? What have you learned from this interview? Let me know on Twitter at WTF4Cities or on the WTF4Cities.com website where the transcripts and show notes are available. You can also subscribe on the website not to miss any new episodes and leave some feedback. I hope this was an interesting interview for you as well, and thanks for tuning in.
What is the Future for Cities podcast?